Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 32. It is June 12th, 2020. The third lesson I teach is indifference. I teach children not to care too much about anything, even though they want to make it appear that they do. How I do this is very subtle. I do it by demanding that they become totally involved in my lessons, jumping up and down in their seats with anticipation, competing vigorously with each other for my favor. It's heartwarming when they do that. It impresses everyone, even me. When I'm at my best, I plan lessons very carefully in order to produce this show of enthusiasm. But when the bell rings, I insist that they drop whatever it is we've been doing and proceed quickly to the next workstation. They must turn on and off like a light switch. Nothing important is ever finished in my class, nor in any class that I know of. Students never have a complete experience except on the installment plan. Indeed, the lesson of bells is that no work is worth finishing, so why care too deeply about anything? Years of bells will condition all but the strongest to a world that can no longer offer important work to do. Bells are the secret logic of school time. Their logic is inexorable. Bells destroy the past and future, rendering every interval the same as any other, as the abstraction of a map renders every living mountain and river the same, even though they are not. Bells inoculate each undertaking with indifference. The fourth lesson I teach is emotional dependency. By stars and red checks, smiles and frowns, prizes, honors and disgraces, I teach kids to surrender their will to the predestinated chain of command. Rights may be granted or withheld by any authority without appeal because rights do not exist inside a school, not even the right of free speech, as the Supreme Court has ruled, unless school authorities say they do. As a school teacher, I intervene in many personal decisions, issuing a pass for those I deem legitimate and initiating a disciplinary confrontation for behavior that threatens my control. Individuality is constantly trying to assert itself among children and teenagers, so my judgments come thick and fast. Individuality is a contradiction of class theory, a curse to all systems of classification. Here are some common ways in which individuality shows up. Children sneak away for a private moment in the toilet on the pretext of moving their bowels. Or they steal a private instant in the hallway on the grounds they need water. I know they don't, but I allow them to deceive me because this conditions them to depend on my favors. Sometimes free will appears right in front of me, in pockets of children angry, depressed, or happy about things outside my ken. Rights in such matters cannot be recognized by school teachers, only privileges that can be withdrawn, hostages to good behavior. The fifth lesson I teach is intellectual dependency. Good students wait for a teacher to tell them what to do. This is the most important lesson of them all. We must wait for other people, better trained than ourselves, to make the meanings of our lives. The expert makes all the important choices. Only I, the teacher, can determine what my kids must study, or rather only the people who pay me can make those decisions, which I then enforce. If I'm told that evolution is a fact instead of a theory, I transmit that as ordered, punishing deviants who resist what I've been told to tell them to think. This power to control what children will think lets me separate successful students from failures very easily. Successful children do the thinking I assign them with a minimum of resistance and a decent show of enthusiasm. Of the millions of things of value to study, I decide what we have time for. Actually, though, this is decided by my faceless employers. The choices are theirs. Why should I argue? Curiosity has no important place in my work, only conformity. Bad kids fight this, of course, even though they lack the concepts to know what they are fighting, struggling to make decisions for themselves about what they will learn and when they will learn it. How can we allow that and survive as school teachers? Fortunately, there are tested procedures to break the will of those who resist. It is more difficult, naturally, if the kids have respectable parents who come to their aid. But that happens less and less, in spite of the bad reputation of schools. No middle-class parents I have ever met actually believe that their kid's school is one of the bad ones. Not one single parent in many years of teaching. That's amazing and probably the best testimony to what happens to families when mother and father have been well-schooled themselves, learning the seven lessons. Good people wait for an expert to tell them what to do. It is hardly an exaggeration to say that our entire economy depends upon this lesson being learned. Think of what might fall apart if children weren't trained to be dependent. The social services could hardly survive. They would vanish, I think, into the recent historical limbo out of which they arose. Counselors and therapists would look on in horror as the supply of psychic invalids vanished. Commercial entertainment of all sorts, including television, would wither as people learned again how to make their own fun. Restaurants, the prepared food industry, and a whole host of other assorted food services would be drastically downsized if people returned to making their own meals rather than depending on strangers to plant, pick, chop, and cook for them. Much of modern law, medicine, and engineering would go too, as well as the clothing business and school teaching, unless a guaranteed supply of helpless people continued to pour out of our schools each year. Don't be too quick to vote for radical school reform if you want to continue getting a paycheck. We've built a way of life that depends on people doing what they are told because they don't know how to tell themselves what to do. It's one of the biggest lessons I teach. Six. The sixth lesson I teach is provisional self-esteem. If you've ever tried to wrestle into line kids whose parents have convinced them to believe that they'll be loved in spite of anything, you know how impossible it is to make self-confident spirits conform. Our world wouldn't survive a flood of confident people very long. So I teach that a kid's self-respect should depend on expert opinion. My kids are constantly evaluated and judged. A monthly report, impressive in its provision, is sent into a student's home to elicit approval or mark exactly down to a single percentage point how dissatisfied with the child a parent should be. The ecology of good schooling depends on perpetuating dissatisfaction, just as the commercial economy depends on the same fertilizer. Although some people might be surprised how little time or reflection goes into making up these mathematical records, the cumulative weight of these objective-seeming documents establishes a profile that compels children to arrive at certain decisions about themselves and their futures based on the casual judgment of strangers. Self-evaluation, the staple of every major philosophical system that ever appeared on the planet, is never considered a factor. The lesson of report cards, grades, tests, is that children should not trust themselves or their parents, but should instead rely on the evaluation of certified officials. People need to be told what they're worth. Seven, one can't hide. The seventh lesson I teach is that one can't hide. I teach students that they are always watched, that each is under constant surveillance by me and my colleagues. There are no private spaces for children. There is no private time. Class change lasts exactly 300 seconds to keep promiscuous fraternization at low levels. Students are encouraged to tattle on each other and even to tattle on their own parents. Of course, I encourage parents to file reports about their own child's waywardness too. A family trained to snitch on itself isn't likely to conceal any dangerous secrets. I assign a type of extended schooling called homework so that the effort of surveillance, if not the surveillance itself, travels into private households where students might otherwise use free time to learn something unauthorized from a father or mother by exploration or by apprenticing to some wise person in the neighborhood. Disloyalty to the idea of schooling is a devil always ready to find work for idle hands. The meaning of constant surveillance and denial of privacy is that no one can be trusted, that privacy is not legitimate. Surveillance is an ancient imperative espoused by certain influential seekers, a central prescription set down in the Republic, the City of God, the Institutes of the Christian Religion, New Atlantis, Leviathan, and a host of other places. All the childless men who wrote these books discover the same thing. Children must be closely watched if you want to keep a society under tight central control. Children will follow a private drummer if you can't get them into a uniformed marching band. Thus ends part one of John Taylor Gatto's The Seven Lesson School Teacher remarks he delivered originally as a speech in 1991 when awarded the Teacher of the Year by the New York State school system. Awesome stuff applies. The critique, I think, applies equally to our media and ourselves. This notion of confusion and class and emotional and intellectual dependency that you can't hide, etc. Fascinating stuff. And quite a contrast to recent readings from Education of a Wandering Man by Louis L'Amour about his rough and tumble. I think he uses the term knockabout. The knockabout years when he left school at 15. Sounds like he was already losing interest at 12. And really because he wasn't allowed to pick his own course of study, that he was being channeled through bells and curricula and tests into a mode that wasn't interesting to him and wasn't fulfilling and didn't further his own personal goals, even at 12 to 15. There are obviously many other models out there that are taking root these days, mostly private schools. And there's obviously a huge debate ongoing about charter schools and school choice and teachers union and the Federal Department of Education, which I think came into being in 1978. No Child Left Behind, which came along, I think, from President Bush, the second President Bush, and et cetera. And, of course, there's a lot going on once you extend the idea of education also into college. What's happening on campuses and the value of the education, especially relative to what it costs, and the spiking of these costs over the last 20 years, far in excess of basic inflation. Every kid is homeschooled, in it, no matter where you go to school. And but, you know, ours is young. No major homework yet. I certainly hear from friends with kids that the volume of homework just gets larger and larger, and standardized tests are areas of major focus. So it's interesting. And I like the commentary, too. I really like to think about Gatto's critique of education overlaid on the media structure. Bells that ring and no place to hide and do what you're told and so-called experts. I'm not against experts at all, but it's clear that a lot of people that have professed to be experts are simply not. I'm not sure what to do about it yet, but I continue to think about it. Hopefully you do too. Thanks, y'all.